So it sounds almost like, I mean, again, this was something that was starting to gain currency in the early part of the 20th century. It almost sounds like Wittgenstein struggling with a kind of social construction of reality.
Yeah.
Rather than there being, you know, one absolute reality. Realities are socially constructed.
Yes.
So and in a way that's how language and communication work. So you could use so the problem becomes not necessarily the kind of the words or the sentences, but the context in which those are used.
Yeah.
So I could say, for example, I don't know, and I'm saying this because, you know, my local chip shop is shut, which is an absolute travesty. I know, gutted, man, because it's really good. But I could say, I love fish and chips. Mm. I could say, I love fish and chips. Now, that does not mean to say that I want to sleep with fish and chips, although it's getting that way now, to be honest. It's not to say that I have an emotional or romantic relationship with fish and chips. Mm. The context of that is that I find fish and chips enjoyable to eat.
Yeah.
I find them tasty.
And it's not chips of wood. It's
way.
Not. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Exactly. But then if I say I love my daughter, that's not saying that, you know, I enjoy, you know, eating her as a kind of form of sustenance, or that, you know, I find her kind of aromatically pleasant. Although, you know, if you're listening, Soren, you are very sweet smelling. I'm talking about, you know, I'm using the word love in an entirely different context. It's a different game here.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, Wittgenstein is saying that this is the key to communication. Mm. Not necessarily just understanding the sentences, but understanding how they're used in a variety of different contexts.
Exactly right. And so you can forget about, you know, essences. You forget about foundations. We're not interested in them.
Mm.
And it's like, what are we doing here, though? What are we doing in philosophy? It's just continually kind of investigating, continually kind of trying to find out as much detail as you can. So with the idea, with the words, there's no single essence, but there's the family resemblances. So like,
yes.
You know,
yes.
My daughter might have my nose or my ears, or you know, her grandfather's eyes, or whatever.
You make it sound like some sort of weird Frankenstein's creature, don't you? Yeah. You construct her in the cellar.
So there are things that link.
Yes.
I think a better way to understand it is when they talk about, I think I mentioned before, a piece of rope. So the rope itself is one thing, but it's made up of lots of different strands that are related to each other.
Yes.
We're moving away. You know, if you burn the rope and the ashes, that's not what a rope is. You know, what is a rope? You know, the famous thing about the broom. You know, change the pole or change the head. Is it still the same broom? Yeah.
I've had this broom for 30 years. I've had to change the head and the handle occasionally, but it's the same. It's the same broom.
That's philosophy from Only Fools and Horses. It's amazing.
Yeah. It really is, isn't it? I mean, I find this fascinating because we've had cause to talk about kind of the impact of social media and technology on our ability to communicate meaningfully with each other. And obviously things have changed as technology becomes more sophisticated. I mean, you know, you and I are in isolation in, you know, WTF bunker, and we've isolated ourselves in different cells for extra safety. But here I am talking to you, and I can see your face and so on. So when we're talking, you know, if you say to me, "Oh, Mike, I hate you," and you're smiling, I can tell that the game we're playing here is not one where you have genuine animosity. Mm. The game we're playing here is playful banter, and that's the game we're playing. So that we're, but if you don't have, if we strip away the context, so for example, I'm thinking, you know, for like just like text speak, or when you're sending text messages through kind of Facebook or whatever, and you just have the bald sentence there, it's very difficult to understand what game's being played. Yeah. And so it's very difficult to understand.
You need the author,
what
isn't it?
Somebody's trying to communicate.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I don't understand what you're saying here. Are you genuinely saying I suck? Or are you just saying it's a bit of a joke here and you're just, it's just you kind of missing about here? Or, you know, are you making, you know, some comment about, you know, my breathing? I mean, you know, what are you actually saying here? Now, I can see that when I'm in a room with you and I can see your face and I can see the kind of the gestures and I can and the context of the podcast and all that kind of stuff. That informs the meaning of that sentence.
Yeah. My favourite one of
these... The sentence...
My favourite one of this is a gesture. So I'm going to have to describe this now because this is radio, obviously. So I've got my my palm facing down. So... and I'm gonna I'm moving my fingers towards Mike.
Right, so you're looking at your palm and you're sweeping your fingers forward
towards me. This is a gesture. So what does it mean?
It's a very weird gesture. It's very weird.
Do that. What does it mean?
Yeah. It looks like a sort of cat flap going on there.
I think so. This gesture, I think, is probably recognisable in England or possibly Europe as a go away gesture. Okay, so you're sweeping you got your palm facing down, and the back of my hand is facing Mike, and I'm sweeping away, like that. It's go away. But in Japanese, this means come here.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think in the West maybe we do it the other way around, put the hand up. I
mean, yes.
We do it like
that. Yeah, fingers facing up.
And that looks like go away, but in Japanese it means come here. Huh. So it's like completely different to the intended meaning of based in context.
Yeah. Mm. But this gets right back to the original intention of Wittgenstein, as I understand it. Right back to the Tractatus, the concern with, you know, what we want to do is we want to be able to communicate effectively, you know, in the world in which we find ourselves. How do we communicate effectively? And, you know, the Tractatus tried to strip it down and simplify it. And then Wittgenstein kind of begins to realise, I think through, you know, increased kind of, I don't know, experience of the world and whatever, that there's more complexity to it than that. And of course, what that raises is the perennial issue about how, you know, do we ever share? I don't know. Do we ever share a context sufficiently with another individual to be able to play the same game? Simple games we can play quite well. So, you know, you could put a board game down. We could probably play Monopoly fairly straightforward because there's a limited rule set about how you play it. Move your pieces around the board, pick up the cards, and exchange your money and so on. But as we start talking about human interaction, social interaction, the rules just become more and more complicated. So it's a case of, okay, this particular phrase means this, but it only means this, you know, if it's a Tuesday and so-and-so is not actually at work that day. And if the weather is not inclement, because if it's inclement and it's pouring with rain or whatever, that will affect the sense of what that means. And if they're not hungry... And if they're not thirsty, and if they've had, you know, had or had not a bad night the night before, and how they slept, you have this increasing selection of rules to that game, which inform the phrase that somebody said. And I just wonder, what, you know, can we ever master a rule set?
That's interesting you say that. But what I would say then is coming at it a different way. The rules of understanding the language, they have been developed. They don't just appear. Mm. So, Wittgenstein talks about Esperanto, which is a kind of a language that was developed, as I understand it, from all different types of languages in Europe. So, a way that we can understand everybody can understand each other. And of course, it was a failure. And Wittgenstein says, like, if you listen to Esperanto, it sounds like jarring. It sounds off. You know, like you could say the similar thing about Klingon.
Yes.
But the point is that the reason it sounds weird and it's not naturally right is it hasn't been developed. One of the things that Wittgenstein keeps banging on about, and sometimes it takes a while to kind of fully appreciate, is that he says that nothing is hidden. Like, so philosophy throughout the ages has been asking these big questions. You know, what is beauty? What is justice? You know, going all the way back to Plato and Socrates. And he's saying that this is a misuse of language. You know, you can't really ask those questions in any kind of meaningful way. They're not natural questions. In that sense, you just use it. That's beautiful. Yeah, I like that. And we know what you mean. Why yes. are we bother? You know, why are we investigating? You know, trying to find some kind of essence of what that is? Because as though we're going to discover something new. But you already know it. You know what? If you understand the word beauty, you understand. You use it correctly. You understand what it means.
Hmm. Okay. I wonder if just make me wonder whether or not there are language games that some of us are never able to play. I mean, in the same way as that there are games that I'm never going to be able to play, because I'm just you know, not capable of playing them. I can't, you know, I'm not going to be able to play football meaningfully. Not that I ever want to. You know, the rules of cricket are beyond me. My ability to play chess effectively is pretty weak. There are all kinds of games. Dungeons and Dragons is almost as completely kind of the rule set has completely gone beyond me, because I think it's rule set 5 now. It's like a multi-volume work. And when I was playing, it was like a thin Tractatus-style volume with like 50 odd pages in it. And a handful of dice, and that was it. Now it's this multi-volume work and so on, and the rule set has now become is beyond me. And I just wonder whether it gets to a point where you can't engage with a particular discourse anymore because you don't understand the rules.
Yeah.
And clearly, the kind of the difference between kind of the, you know, the old and the young, where the meaning of words and their attitude to particular kind of issues and their appreciation of particular sounds and vision and all that stuff, and the kind of cultural context, all of that stuff that informs their discourse. If you're not part of that, how much of that game can you meaningfully be part of?
We could put it a different way. We talk about language and culture. I understand what you're saying, and I think I agree. And another one is, like, I always think about recommendations for people. And I love, as you know, I love anime and lots of different types of anime. And there's an anime called Crayon Shin-chan. And it's a kind of like kind of naughty little boy, and there's in Japan, and it gets in kind of interesting adventures. And they did a kind of dubbed version of it, which is awful. So I think, okay, you should watch the Japanese version with the subtitles. But to really properly appreciate it, you really must had some kind of understanding of Japanese culture. So some of the jokes, some of the references, I know that situation. I've seen it, and that's why that's funny. You won't be able to appreciate that as much if you don't know it behind it. So in that way, it's a little bit like if you don't, let's say that there's a nation on Earth, a nation that we don't know that very well, that has its own language. And it's really, really difficult language to learn. But we know that Chomsky, anybody can born into that country can learn that language. We have that kind of innate ability to learn language. But let's say no one's done that, but it's very difficult to understand that language. Pratt says insights that they have about the world that it's very difficult for them, for us to appreciate unless we unless we can learn their language. They have words for things, you know, like we have, like onomatopoeia, which is a kind of direct pinpoint something, you know, click. We know what that is. Click. Mm. We understand what that is. But they maybe have this language that's more close to understanding the more difficult things of the universe than we do.
It causes me a concern sometimes, because you hear people you hear people saying stuff that just frankly to you makes no sense. Either it just seems stupid or dangerous, you might listen to some sort of political rhetoric and you might hear people saying, oh, well, okay, you know, this is the best course of action. This is the best course of action for the nation. And you're sitting there thinking, I understand that sentence. This is the best course of action. But I don't understand how this applies to what you're talking about, because for me, that doesn't seem like the best course of action. And you think, well, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe they're talking about a game that I don't understand. Maybe there are elements of the game. I mean, I increasingly think that the people are kind of adding rules to the game behind my back anyway. And that's probably why I don't understand much these days. But, I mean, it may well be somebody who's working with an economic rule set. And they're saying the best course of action for the nation is this. And by that they mean economically the best. It is going to stave off economic collapse, or it's going to stave off, you know, deflation, or it's going to stave off inflation, or it's going to do something. Whereas my language game is an ethical one, perhaps. Whereas I'm saying, well, what's best is, you know, if human beings are dealt with dignity and respect. So I don't understand how you're saying this is best, because this is not best. This is not best because this is devaluing human beings and it's treating them like things. And surely this is a bad thing. Whereas you firmly believe this is best. But the rule set you're using is an economic one.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, and that's just two very broad tool sets. Somebody might be working with an aesthetic toolkit. Somebody might be working with a scientific toolkit. Somebody might be working with a religious rule set. This is one of the things that Wittgenstein is trying to explore. Is kind of, how do we communicate with each other without understanding? We need to try and understand the rule sets and somehow kind of get a handle on those so we can see what's going on.
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely sure whether that's something we can do. And I'll leave you with this one tell me what I've misunderstood here. In the film Interview with a Vampire, do you remember Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire? It was like, I think Tom Cruise in it or something. And you had the vampires, and they lived forever, as a vampire does. And you can see them kind of going through history and learning different ways of dressing and different ways of speaking and appreciating different kinds of music, and adapting and becoming part of various talk. And then they visit a bunch of, I think it's like Tom Cruise and Antonio Banderas, or whoever it is. They're in Paris, and they end up going down into the kind of the crypts below Paris. I don't know if there are crypts, but I'm just assuming there are. And you see all these kind of these vampires who've been living for, you know, centuries, all just sat in their kind of tombs, kind of all kind of curled up, kind of grunting and not doing much. I said, what the hell's happened to these guys? It's got to a point where they cannot assimilate any more rules. That they've got to that point. So I think I might even mention this before. It's a bit like kind of my grandmother who just got to a point where it's just kind of, no, I don't want a DVD player because I just can't. I just don't understand how they work. It makes no sense to me. It's like sorcery. I'm just going to let it go. So that kind of, you know, does it get to a point where it's just kind of, no, there are just too many rules. There are too many volumes. I can't understand this anymore. Are we always? I mean, is Wittgenstein basically saying that we're all destined to misunderstand each other ultimately forever?
I don't know. I don't think he would say about that. I know what you're saying. I think it is about getting older, isn't it? I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, "The young are the only are the only ones who have the experience to understand my work." But I think, I don't know. I mean, what we're trying to say is that we get to a point where we can't take it on board the kind of new ways of looking at things. I think that's probably true. I mean, I feel it already. I sometimes feel like stuff that, you know, my son watches, or sometimes I like some of the things he's doing, and I think, well, he's obviously a different stage of life from me, but also what he's watching is not for me. It's not being created for me, you know. Like a lot of the, you know, music used to be a big thing. I don't think it's a big thing anymore. It doesn't seem like that. But maybe it's because it's not for me anymore.
It's just noise now. Yeah, it's just Danny. Noise. It's just noise. It's
nothing you could sing along to.
Yeah, you can't really dance.
Nothing like good old stuff like Rammstein. You know, it's all. I don't know. I think that's a good question. I don't think I really have a proper answer. I don't think Wittgenstein would give you that. He was definitely very pessimistic. He died in 1951, and by that time it's like, yeah, the world's finished. Civilization itself is disintegrating. You know, this is it's a decaying age. But he was, very much. But the weird thing about him is that he did this constantly, saying that he wanted to commit suicide. But when his last words were, "I had," someone said to him, "Your friends are going to come. Please stay with us." He was dying. He was on his deathbed, and he said, "Tell them I've had a wonderful life," which is considering the things he said during his
life. How miserable he was.
Very, very miserable. he was very negative about that. I think he did like. So it's 1930s, 1940s. He was inspired by by the youth, especially like working class youth. He couldn't be doing with anyone who was kind of living in a kind of bubble of privilege. I think during World War II, he said it was immoral to do philosophy, sit around.
Oh, really?
And he gave up. He became a night porter or a porter anyway for one of the big hospitals in London. And he liked to hang around with the kind of working class people. He felt that but he couldn't help himself. You know, he as soon as he got into a place, he started arranging how best it should be run. And then he did he just reeled off things, built a house. He stayed in Newcastle for a while, in a hospital there, and he did research in trauma. He did like valuable research in trauma. Just shooting things off. And when he was a teacher, he wrote a dictionary, German dictionary. Oh. That was the second book he ever published in his lifetime, his dictionary.
So I mean, if we wanted to kind of wrap this up a bit, Wittgenstein, as we know, is clearly your go-to guy. He was the guy you chose to do research on, and you still have a thing for him now. What's the primary attraction?
Yeah, it's a good question.
To his philosophy, to his philosophy, and to him as a guy, as a person, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. It's a question I've asked myself a few times. And when I first studied Wittgenstein, I always went into philosophy classes and been introduced to new stuff with kind of enthusiasm. But I remember I was flung straight in with the philosophical investigations. I think it was kind of. We didn't even look at the Tractatus, and I thought, okay, here we go. I was lying on the beach. I grabbed, because it was just right before starting term, I grabbed a philosophical invasion. I'd get ahead here, and I thought, I'm never going to get this. This is you know, this is really difficult, and it looks really, really simple. But it's really what's the point here? There's no thing laid out for you. It wasn't till later that I had to study him again, and I did the Tractatus and philosophical investigations, and that kind of something went off. First of all, it's the challenge. You know, Wittgenstein's a really difficult philosopher, and that's kind of okay. Well, if I understand it, that make me seem clever, right? but then there's kind of the realization that he is unlike any other kind of philosopher, and so a lot of people don't like him and kind of almost dismiss him. There was one, I think it was A.C. Grayling wrote one of the Potted Guides, and I read it, was really good. And but he also said in it that you know, everyone thinks a lot of Wittgenstein now, but one day he'll be like one of the forgotten philosophers. And it was almost outrageous to me, because I thought that, for me, he's up there. You know, he's up there with Descartes, Kant, through the 19th century philosophers, and Wittgenstein, because I think he completely changed everything. But also, he made me think again after the kind of, you know, the existentialism and Marxism and all that. You get kind of wrapped up in that. You think that's really radical and important. And then you get like the postmodernism stuff, and it all everything sort of kind of crumbles, and that kind of makes you lose interest a bit. And Wittgenstein, some people would put him under postmodernism, which is, I think, is fine. But for him, he's like, what is philosophy? It's about therapy, he says. You know, it's therapeutic. Yeah, we've got these problems. Yeah. And he re-evaluates what philosophy is, and it makes it more, I think it makes it exciting again. And I could kind of pinpoint a time when I kind of got the Tractatus and understood that the important things are things that are outside kind of our logical space. And I saw, I mentioned this before, I saw a sunset, and it was kind of, obviously, I don't have the words. This is what Wittgenstein's talking about. I don't have the words to say it, but something about that sunset seemed to penetrate my reality and kind of renew. I get it. It's that's really something. I'm trying to touch with words, but it's impossible. It's something that's touching my soul, and then you're reduced to using language that would be dismissed from the Tractatus. So from then on. Yeah, I really loved Wittgenstein's work, and always will think about it in my whenever I'm studying philosophy.
So he definitely belongs on your philosophical Mount Rushmore.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that, you know, we've had an opportunity for you to actually say Wittgenstein a lot. Yeah. Today, rather than just to try and lever him in, I think that's been really, really fascinating. Really kind of opened up aspects of the guy's thinking and work that I hadn't really appreciated.
Well, I hope I kind of made sense and did it justice, because it is really difficult. And like I said before, it's like going into training, reading the Tractatus, I've never really read the Tractatus. I've read. The Tractatus is there, and I have the guide to the Tractatus, and I'm reading the guide to the Tractatus and referring to the Tractatus. But read the Tractatus from start to finish is impossible, I think. Well, not impossible. Obviously, for someone else could do it, but for me, it is impossible, and it's painful because you could write a book about every single proposition, and obviously there's hundreds. But if anyone was interested in understanding of Wittgenstein, I recommend. I've got the book here in front of me. Ludwig Wittgenstein, The Duty of Genius. I'll show you so you can see it. Mm-hmm. By Ray Monk.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I asked one of my lecturers, I'm not getting this. What should I do? He said, read this book. And it's very illuminating, and it's a wonderful way of getting making Wittgenstein's human. and it goes very nicely with his philosophy, and you really get to grips with it that way. Mm. Yeah.
Well, we've all got plenty of time to sit around and read over the next however many months we're all locked up. So I ordered that one.